Hello and welcome along to an episode this week's, another bonus episode in fact, of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. I'm slightly giddy because I've actually just come down from hosting 21st Century Soundtracks, number 34 of this year's Proms, which saw the most fantastic collection of pieces from films, a lot of which we've talked about on this show, from some of the most amazing composers. Who did you have? Jerskine, Fendrix, we had Hildegard Knottier, Isabel Waller-Bridge, Max Richter, so many. It was wonderful. If you want to check that out, it's available on BBC iPlayer for you to watch. So yeah, it was wonderful. Royal Albert Hall, Rob Ames conducting. I was in heaven. As I am every time I come along to introduce you to one of my conversations, particularly this week, because I had a blast with our guest. Our latest guest, as I said, is this bonus episode, and it's with Paul Feig, who returns to Soundtracking to discuss his latest film, Jackpot, which is streaming now on Prime Video. Starring Awkwafina and John Cena, Jackpot is a dark comedy caper set in the near future where winners of a huge lottery only get to keep their billions if they avoid being killed by anyone who wants to have a go by sundown. Despite this dark premise, it's very much fast-paced, gag-driven slapstick in which both the protagonists shine. As well as boasting an as-yet unreleased score by Theodore Shapiro, Jackpot has loads of cracking needle drops, including For the Love of Money by the OJs. Money, 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 money.
How are you?
I'm really well, thank you very much. Great way to start a week, getting to chat to you about a new film. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you too.
You have such a great relationship with music and the use of music in your films, which we'll dive into in a bit. And this is a great example of having the two worlds of score and existing music that you've used brilliantly in Jackpot. I dived into a few interviews that you've already done about the film, and just hearing, it was very funny you hearing about the original title of the film. You're like, no, I'm not going to bother reading that. And then being encouraged to go, no, have a look at the story, because I think it's you. It's nice to have those people around you who can kind of guide you and push you in the direction of things sometimes.
Very much so. Very much. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you get overwhelmed sometimes because there's so much stuff coming at you, and you make these snap decisions. That, yeah, you kind of go like, oh gosh, like, thank God somebody, you know, if I hadn't made this movie, I'd be really sad.
Yeah. What was it then, once you dived into the script and kind of got into the story and the characters, that you really kind of connected with, do you think, that were like, yeah, this is for me, I want to do this?
Yeah, to me, it's a really good-natured, dark film. Yeah, it's a very dark concept at its core, the idea that there's a lottery, and if you win, everybody who with a losing ticket has until sundown to kill you and take your prize legally. But the fact that there was no guns, like one of the rules, you can't use guns, that made it more fun to me, because then it's just about trying to survive hand-to-hand, you know, which is just a springboard for so much physical comedy. And I loved the characters. I thought the two lead characters that Awkwafina and John Cena play were lovely characters. That she's this kind of, struggling actress who comes back to town, and you kind of find out it's because, her mom, she lost her mom, and she's, trying to honor her mom who wanted her to be an actress. That's a very sweet, and that she's, defender of people. The first time we meet her, she's on a bus and she defends some little girl who's getting yelled at by her dad. And so you immediately love her and you care about her. And she's got all these trust issues because of things that happened in her past. But then you meet John's character, and he's like this really good-hearted guy who shows up and wants to do the right thing. And he's, he has a business where he protects you for a commission on your earnings, but he really cares about his clients. And even though there's, you're not sure if you trust him in the beginning, I just like that he's not only like very good-natured and sweet, he also doesn't want to hurt people. Like, he know his job is to get people away from her, but he doesn't want to like physically wound them. And so, even though he's throwing somebody out of a car, he'll put a helmet on them first and says, "I'm gonna throw somebody out of a car without a moving car without a helmet. I'm not a monster." And I like it. It's not a toxic, masculine kind of, action hero. It's just a relatable working guy who wants to do the right thing.
As much as characters and relationships can be written brilliantly on the page, when it comes to kind of finding that energy with actors realistically on, in front of the camera, you can't kind of predict that, and as much as you can write it, you can't prepare it. This feels like there was something really, really brilliant between John and Awkwafina in terms of the time and the chemistry, just the energy they had with each other. Would that be fair?
Oh yeah, no, they brought it, to life so beautifully. Because you're right, you don't know. I mean, you can write the greatest script in the world, and I've seen the greatest scripts in the world and read them, and then I've seen the movie, and you're like, that boy, that didn't work at all. And it usually comes down to the way it's directed and the actors who are playing it. Yeah, they are the ones that make it live and breathe, and you have to make sure A, the audience relates to them individually, but then that chemistry is there. And there's no way to test chemistry. You can if you're at a point where you're hiring new actors and you go, "Let's have an audition, and you guys will read together." We did that for Bridesmaids. We brought all the women in together and mix and match them until we found the right gang. But with this, you got two stars. You don't make them audition, and you don't say, "Oh, let's come in and see if you guys get along." You just kind of take the leap and you hire them. But I found that like the most talented people I work with, especially in comedy, have chemistry because they so rely on each other, and they're not coming in competition. They really want to make each other look good because then that makes them look good. And I think from that willingness and openness comes chemistry. And I can always pick up when I just go like, "God, those people are either they're not connecting, or they're just kind of competing against each other."
And when you see that, when you are starting to film and you kind of see that there is this kind of thing and this natural kind of ability for them to be really sort of to listen to each other and to give each other space and the opportunity to shine and be their best that they can be, does that then for you as a director give them the opportunity to kind of push that more? Do you give them more opportunity to improvise and, get what's on the page, but then play with things?
Yeah, no, I always do that with all the characters. I mean, from top to bottom, even the person with one line, I want to bring in somebody who I know is gonna plus it up and can bring their personality and their comedy to it. So yeah, the worst thing you can do when you're making a comedy is just shoot the script. And again, like you're saying, on the page, but once you're on the set in the real world and you've got humans doing it, and there's extras around them, and there's all the stuff that's happening, and they're in costumes, it changes everything. It's what is on the page suddenly might be limiting to what is actually happening there. So then you want to be able to expand it, let them live and breathe in the character and react the way they would normally react. You stick to the script in that you stick to the blueprint of the story and the arc and the beats of the story, but how people express themselves within that blueprint, that's where the personality comes from. And that's where the movie starts to take on its own life and where the audience starts to go, "Oh, they invest in these people."
When do you know you've got it? In terms of you've shot the page, but then you are playing and you're giving them that freedom. When do you know when to stop? When do you know when to go, okay, we've got enough versions of that, let's move on?
Think you just naturally feel it. You kind of go, "I'm out of ideas," and Anything, you know, a lot of times I'll be like, anything else you guys want to try or anything? And usually people just go like, no, I think we're good. You know, we'll find it. But then sometimes people are like, there's one thing. Can I try it? And I'm like, that'd be great. You know, and sometimes it's completely a left field thing. And sometimes it's awesome. And sometimes you're like, okay, well, we tried it and we have it now. But I find more often than not, though, those last minute things that people have tend to be the best thing, because it's something that just comes fresh out of their mind. And it's something we wouldn't have thought of. And that's what audiences really like. You know, as an audience member, anything we watch, we hate anything predictable. You know, there's nothing worse than going, okay, I know it's going to happen next. And then it happens. You're like, okay, well, you know, I called it, versus like, I didn't think that was going to happen. That's the greatest thing for an audience.
Well, I think that both Awkwafina and John are very much in that. They epitomize that in a way, you know, in terms of they're almost like timeless performers in a way. They kind of embody so many different eras of film that I've grown up watching and things, and kind of really have fun with that, the physical side of it, the kind of almost silent movie, so the expression is so important, right, and things like that. And they just look like this was a great opportunity for them to play in that kind of ring of, you know, embracing all those different types of things they can bring to comedy.
Well, I mean, that's a great observation. I really like the description of them as timeless, because it there is. I mean, there's so many inspirations from across the movie, you know, movie spectrum of eras and decades and all that, because we're so, you know, James Young, the stunt coordinator, and myself are so inspired by Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin and then Warner Brothers cartoons of the Three Stooges, you know, but then Jackie Chan and all these things. And so we wanted to make this just like a big melange, if you will, of all these different influences that were all in service of making people laugh.
When it came to music, what, if anything, was in the script? And then, you know, Theodore, the composer, you know, who you've worked with, you know, numerous times over the years. And when it comes to, sorry, so many thoughts in my head trying to get a question out. But but when it comes to composing for comedy, and comedy is such a unique genre, I think, where it's almost kind of like a buffet of genres, where you've got kind of comedy at the heart, but then you can pull in different genres within that. And, you know, like you say, the kind of the idea of this film with what the jackpot's for, it's dark, you know, but that adds to the comedy in a way as well. And Theodore is a master of embracing that through his score work, both the work he's done with you, but things like, I don't know, Old School, Tropic Thunder, Blades of Glory, all that kind of stuff as well. Yeah. But talk to me a little about the music and when you start thinking about it and how much was in the script.
Yeah, well, I mean, just going off of Teddy, you know, Teddy and I have one rule, which is never compose a comedy score for a comedy. You know, we want dramatic, you know, serious scores, because that just makes the comedy funnier, because it's being treated seriously. You know, there's nothing I hate more than a comedy score of like, you know, like, you know, like, it just, totally. I mean, literally all it does is tell the audience, I think that's supposed to be funny. Like, I think I'm supposed to be laughing at this. And I find it offensive, because it doesn't trust the characters and doesn't trust the comedy, but it usually means you got to bad comedy on top of it. But this, I mean, I usually script a lot of songs specifically into my scripts, or put them in as I'm doing my rewrites. And this one didn't really have anything kind of pre-planned for, because it's such a chase. Teddy and I, our first discussion was like, what is the sound of this? And we were both like, this is kind of a video game, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's, if you notice, there's a lot of, Teddy used a lot of video game like sounds and instruments in it. So there's that Pac-Man, that thing and all that. We just thought, let's play with that. Let's make it a serious action score, but like put the video game elements in lightly. We didn't want to hit it too hard. And there was some versions that Teddy did where we both went like, okay, we hit that too much. So it's that, but then you want to find these islands of, you don't want a movie to be completely score driven and you don't want it to be completely song driven at the same time, because that starts to sound like an indie film. And, you know, we were trying to make a big commercial film here. So one of my favorite cues is, you know, we had score all through that car chase, and we were getting a lot of feedback from our test audiences that the car chase just felt too long. And I didn't agree with it because I knew we were hitting these beats that we wanted to hit. But then I went like, maybe we're just too score heavy in here. And so that's when I pulled out that LCD sound system, you know, us versus them, which has always been one of my favorite songs. And I've been trying to get in a movie forever. And I was just like, why don't we, Erica Weiss, my music editor, I said, like, drop that on the scene. Let's just see what happens. And it just gave it this drive because it unified through a section that felt to the audience like we were being episodic. It unified mm-hmm. it. And it put it all together. And it worked miracles, because then suddenly we stopped getting the feedback that the car chase was too long.
The time has come. The time has come. The time has come today. The time has come. The time has come. The time has come today.
That then, you know, Erica Weiss has been on all my movies, and she's really good at, I usually give a list of songs I want to put in something, but then before I go in and do my cut, when we're just, you know, she's assembling while we're shooting still, she'll throw in songs, and so many times she'll put in a song, I'm like, that's great, I'm not even going to try to top that song, you know, and she did that for a bunch of places in this. But then when we got to, there's a montage when everybody discovers where Nora's character, you know, Awkwafina's character is at the end, towards the end of the movie, and they all got rushed. We had Nowhere to Run To, but like this kind of cool version of it. And I was like, oh, that works really great. And then I saw, there's another movie I saw that had just come out, and they used the same song, that same version. I was like, oh, crap, I'm not going to use the same song from them. And so then it put us all in this turmoil. We were trying songs and they weren't working. And then I was like, I went like, wait a minute. When we did Simple Favor, we had this whole sequence where right after, you know, Henry Golding and Anna Kendrick's characters start kind of falling in love, where they're at a concert, the school concert. And I wrote into the concert, the kids are going to be singing the Brady Bunch song. What's the Sunshine Day? It's a Sunshine Day. They were singing it, and then we had this band called No Small Children, who does music for a lot of my movies. They're this kind of punk band that are these teachers, school teachers, and they're great.
Right.
And so I said, like, oh, they should do a cover of Sunshine Day, and we'll use it somewhere else in the movie. So they did it for the movie. When we put the movie together, it's all these sex scenes over this Brady Bunch song, and it was really disturbing. And I was like, we can't do this. It's just too much. And so we threw that out, and we didn't use their version of that song. So it'd been sitting around for like 6 years. And I was just sitting there and go like, Erica, do you have that song? Do you have the Sunshine Day song? And she's like, yeah. And we put it on. It's like, that's it. It works great. So out of the ashes came the punk of Sunshine Day.
Never been anything. Just stick it in a folder. It'll come up useful at some point for sure.
Always, always.
I think I'll go for a walk outside now. Some sun's calling my name. I, you know, just can't stay inside all day. I've got
Funny as well, because there's, I mean, there's great needle drops in the film, whether it's, you know, Beach Boys or Weezer or, you know, and also just that proper like belly laughing out loud when I Like to Move It kind of comes on as well, you know, and kind of, it's almost kind of, the music sometimes can be a companion sometimes, and, you know, in the film in a way, or in the experience.
No, honestly, that Move It was something, because I'm the DJ on the radio, just because you know, it's easier for me to do it than somebody else. So and I am in SAG. So, but yeah, it was like, because we had some other song there. I was like, and I had to put something in about like the ticking clock, going like, hey, there's only 8 hours left or whatever, because we didn't have a marker of like, the audience was confused of the timeline. Mm-hmm. So I put that in, and then was writing and go like, you know, so Katie better move it. And there's like, oh, wait, why don't we get that song Move It? And then so it was just a joke that kind of built naturally that we put in.
I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. You like to move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. Come on, you're cold. How you doing, you know? Bitch, you're not joking, buddy. You want me to pop one up? Come on, you're cold. How you doing, you know? Bitch, you're not joking, buddy.
And the Weezer song actually was, that was just, we were putting that sequence together, and I just love, I'm a Weezer fanatic. I have been forever. I mean, Pinkerton is my favorite album of all time. And we just had this, you know, driving through California thing, and I was just like, let's grab Beverly Hills, man. And we put it in, the minute we put it in, it was like, we're not touching this. This works too perfect.
Yeah, it's almost like you created a kind of road trip playlist for us. It was absolutely perfect. Yeah.
Oh, thanks. No, I my favorite thing is putting music on the movies. It's just the greatest.
Where I come from isn't all that great. My automobile is a piece of crap. My fashion sense is a little whack. And my friends are just as creepy as me. I didn't go to boarding schools. Preppy girls never looked at me. Why should they? I ain't nobody, got nothing in my pocket.
I mean, you've done it so well, like, you know, across so many of the films. And it was really interesting as well, you know, kind of just hearing your adoration and respect for Jackie Chan and Jackie Chan films. And that was kind of really lovely to hear, you know, in terms of, you know, that journey that he had as a performer, you know, from kind of Hong Kong to Hollywood in a way, sort of thing as well. And I wondered if there were any, as someone who's not really that familiar with his huge body of work, if you had any recommendations of something of his that we should watch.
Yeah, no, I love all his Hong Kong movies. You know, I mean, one of my favorite films he did is called Drunken Master 2. There's a Drunken Master 1. You don't have to see Drunken Master 1 to enjoy Drunken Master 2. But it's got some of the most inventive action fight scenes in it that are really funny and just really crazy. He's got this series of movies called Police Story. Mm-hmm. And the first one especially is just really fun. But those are all really fun. I think it's, you know, a lot of people talk about like Rush Hour and those things, which are his Hollywood ones. I like those, but it's those Hong Kong ones that are the best, because that's just pure Jackie making movies with those, you know, these, I think they're called the Red Pants Brigade or something, that the stunt men who work in Hong Kong are crazy. because they literally destroy themselves. I mean, you'll see stunts and you're like, oh my God, like, how did they do that? The guy must kill himself. Like, oh no, he really just fell and he was in the hospital for like 4 weeks, you know, like lands on his back off of like the second story of something. So it's kind of an amazing spectacle of just people just throwing themselves into this idea of trying to get laughs and trying to make Jackie Chan look really funny and in danger and all that. So, yeah, so I'd go back. I would start with Drunken Master 2 and Police Story if you want to get a nice prime.
Right. It's a great place to start. It really, really is. You mentioned Bridesmaids there. I can't believe that it's been, what, 13 years since we had Bridesmaids?
Because now it's been 13 years. Isn't that crazy?
Crikey. It's about time we had a sequel, Paul. I'm just gonna say.
There you go. Exactly. I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but never said, right?
if nothing else, just to encourage us all to have another opportunity to do Hold On as karaoke.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's always there for us.
That film still, it just stands the test of time so brilliantly. And also just kind of given, like you say, it was so, I didn't realize of that idea of kind of, you know, that jigsaw puzzle of those wonderful women in that film and what each of those characters kind of brought to it. It was an introduction to us to so many of them that we weren't aware of. And it's been beautiful to kind of see them flourish and do brilliant, brilliant things sort of thing as well. What's your kind of memories of that film and the response that it got and still gets as well?
Yeah, I mean, it was such a fun film to make, you know. I mean, those women were just so wonderful to work with, and they were so into it and so supportive of each other and just trying to make each other laugh and trying to get the most laughs that they could for each other. It was really just a lovely experience every day. I just laughed all the time. And, you know, it was just always like, they were so funny offset. It's like, oh, that thing you just did, you know, in your chairs, let's do it in the scene because it's so much fun. So I think that's why it has the resonance that it does, because it just felt so honest, because they were so honest and they were so much being themselves, even in those characters. And then it's just, I mean, the fact that it's stood the test of time. I mean, it's definitely the movie of mine that everybody knows the most, you know. And there was just, I had to miss it, which killed me, because I was coming here to do, you know, flying to London to do a lot of press. And on Saturday night, they did this thing in LA. It's called Cinespia. And it's at the Hollywood Cemetery, which is a massive place. They do these outdoor screenings, and they did one of Bridesmaids that I was supposed to kind of host and all that. So I only did a tape for it, but my assistant was there, and he sent me video. It had to be thousands of people sitting there getting ready to watch this movie. And I was just like, wow, after all these years, it can still draw that many people and they, you know, go crazy for it, because it's, you know, it is so funny. I mean, you know, I just think it's such a funny movie. I was happy to be a part of it, but I mean, it's really because of those people on that screen, you know, that just made it so much fun.
It is. It's so relatable, because there are so many elements of each of those characters and situations that you find them in that you go, yeah, I've been there, or yeah, that's me. And I think that was just the beautiful thing. One of the many beautiful things about it was that we saw ourselves in the film.
Yeah, and that's what all I look for in any project I take on, no matter what the genre, no matter how, you know, if it's fantasy or wherever it goes, there has to be a relatable core in the middle. You have to go, that's me. I would do that. That would be me in the middle of that situation. Or, oh my God, I wouldn't have thought to do that, but I'd like to think I would have come up with that. You know, it's that empathy you have for characters. That's what draws you into a movie. And with comedy, you know, it's comedies seem easy because it's just like, yeah, you just do a bunch of jokes. But really, you know, I always say my movies are dramas that are funny, because you have to plot them out like dramas. They have to have this emotional resonance. You have to have a driving story in the middle that you care about. You have to worry about the characters. Are they in danger, either physical danger or emotional danger? And that then, it's the characters within that and how they're reacting to the extreme situation and the extreme characters around them that creates the comedy, you know. But that's, you have to be very aware of that, because you want that response, like you said, of like, you see yourself in these characters, you care about them. You know, that's a bunch of jokes don't mean anything to people. It's funny for a while, and then you start looking at your watch, you know, going like, is this over yet? So you really got to invest in those characters.
When you look at what what you're working on in terms of what we can look forward to in the future, you know, always very kind of busy and proactive in what things on you, like 20 upcoming producer projects on the go, as well as, you know, directing and writing as well. What kind of informs your decision on what you want to do next, you know, in terms of, are you looking for something specific, or are you is it depend on the project, I guess, as well?
It depends on the project. I'm just looking for what I think is going to entertain an audience. I mean, that's really my only goal as a filmmaker is to make things that people want to see and people want to watch again and again. And so it makes it a very broad target, but at the same time, it narrows the target because there's so many things that don't fall into that category. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's just an idea that you go like, I don't know if I can get an audience to come see that because it doesn't on its face look interesting or different enough for them. But then the other side of it is, but I don't know if we can make that really big idea into something people would care about. I don't know if I can get, you know, emotion in the middle of that. So you're really trying to find these two things. And also, I'm a commercial filmmaker. I'm not like an independent filmmaker. I have to, you know, my movies cost a certain amount of money to make because they have big production. And so they have to make money, you know, they have to, whether it's a streamer, they have to get a lot of eyeballs on it. People, a lot of people have to click on it, or if it's in theaters, they have to go and pay the money for the ticket. So, yeah, so it just becomes this, you have to be honest with yourself and say, if I didn't know me and I just saw the trailer for this, would I go, I got to see that? Or I'd be like, okay, I'll wait and see that when it comes on TV. And it's, you'd be amazed how many things that weeds out.
I am definitely already ready to buy my ticket for your musical project, Untitled Musical Project, that I see. I mean, whether to believe IMDb or not, it's up there and I am on board.
It's a long-term goal to do musicals, so we'll see. I mean, they're really hard to develop, I'll tell you that. They're really hard to get right. I wouldn't do it till I did, but I hope we do it.
Got everything crossed. And then the other one I wanted to ask just quickly before we finish is, I noticed, an upcoming project is Motherland. And I wondered if that was an adaptation of the TV show.
Yeah, it was. And Sharon Horgan was involved and everybody. And we a pilot was written and we shot it and it was great. And then the network decided they didn't want to do it.
Oh,
and
no.
It was really heartbreaking for us because we had an amazing cast of Ellie Kemper, you know, who was in.
Oh, yeah.
Ellie and Judy Greer was in it. And Karin Soni, who's been in a bunch of my stuff. And Michael Showalter directed it. And we just thought it was a total slam dunk, and just the network just decided they didn't want to do it. So, you know, that's the sad thing in this business. It's, yeah. As much as you think you've kind of safety'd something so that it can't fail, it just up to the whims of kind of the powers that be. And I don't fault anybody for not picking stuff up. You just sometimes you're just like, wow, really? I can't believe you didn't pick that up because it came out great. It's really fun. So sadly, but who knows? I mean,
yeah, it's in the file. It's in the file. It might, you never know.
Exactly.
I want the last question and really appreciate your time. We're talking about music and scores and things. Is there a score for you that you go back to more and more? And that could either be, you know, a traditional score in terms of by a composer or a collection of songs that are used in a film. Is there one that you go back to the most?
Well, there's things I take away from scores. Carter Burwell's score for Fargo was a big influence on me because, like, when we were going to do Simple Favor, I called up Teddy before, you know, we were in pre-production. I said, let's come up with our 7-8 note theme. Because like that fiddle thing that just starts that is so beautiful to me. And it's so haunting the way that he uses it through all of, you know, and it just keeps coming back in. And Teddy sat down and wrote that, you know, da 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 for Simple Favor. And I just love that. And so we're always kind of going like, what's our main theme? What is it? And then we're also very hung up on like each character having their own theme, you know, which a lot of composers do, obviously. So, but other soundtracks I go back to, my favorite soundtracks ever, David Shire's piano soundtrack, all piano soundtrack for The Conversation, which is the most haunting score ever.
I just spoke to Walter about that a couple of weeks ago for the anniversary, the editor.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. They had an anniversary.
Oh, Walter Merge. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Really? Oh,
so
I love Walter.
He was amazing. Yeah. He came on. We talked loads about it. And some amazing stories about that. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, it was fascinating. So it's amazing you mentioned that. But yeah, I absolutely agree.
I just love it. And then the Tangerine Dream soundtrack for Risky Business was a game that if I think that affected me more than anything, because it's a comedy and it has this, I don't even call it a serious score. It's just like, it's not a comedy. That's not a comedy score at all. That's like a heavy, like emotional score. And it's so gorgeous. And so that really affects me. Koyaanisqatsi by Philip Glass. I mean, it's all about the music for that, but that's unbelievable. Yeah, I think. And then the Moon. Did Carter Burwell do Moon? I'm trying to think.
No, that was Clint Manso.
That's it, Clint. Yeah. That's another score that I play. I just play in the car. Oh, and then finally, Stuart Copeland's Rumblefish, one of the best ever. And he ended up doing a movie for me. I did a movie called I Am David, and Stuart scored it, and it was just like I was a kid in heaven.
Paul, it's really lovely and really kind of clear to see how much music is part of your kind of collaboration and storytelling. It's been joyous to chat to you about it. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you. I love talking about music, and you don't normally get to talk about it for movies. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I'll see you tonight. I'm doing the Q&A tonight, so I'll see you in person
tonight.
Oh, it's
you. So I look forward fantastic. To, yeah. Oh, I'm thrilled. Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Have a great day, and I'll see you later.
Cheers. Thanks, I'll see you there.
Selected from one of Paul Feig's favourite soundtracks, that's Love on a Rail Train by Tangerine Dream. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the Jack Pock director. My huge thanks to Paul for taking the time to talk to us, as I mentioned. Jack Pock is streaming on Prime Video now, so if you fancy escaping on the sofa for a wee while, do give it a go. Paul mentioned several folk that we've had on the podcast, including Carter Burwell and Clint Mansell, and you can find those episodes at edithbowman.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on our socials. We're at Soundtracking UK, and we have a YouTube channel too called Soundtracking Extra. We'd really appreciate you subscribing to that and also the podcast if you get a second. Next up, really excited to share with you on Monday, composer Martin Phipps to discuss his work on The Crown as well as Napoleon and working with Ridley Scott. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.